I think we're going to go ahead and get started. As Joseph said, I'm Scott Turner. I'm from the San Francisco Fed. So we've been here for 2 days. We've heard from a Federal Reserve governor, 3 Reserve Bank presidents, several notable keynotes, including a cabinet secretary, 5 different panels, 10 hours of discussion. It kind of raises the question, why are you still here and what more is there to say? Well, so maybe you're here to eat your box lunch, but we do think we have more to say, and I'd like to think we maybe save the best panel for last. Just very briefly, starting at the far end, we have George Mac McCarthy, who directs the Metropolitan Opportunities Program at the Ford Foundation. We then have Frank Alexander, who is the Sam Nunn Professor of Law at Emory Law School and is also Director of Policy and Research at the new Center for Community Progress. Then we have Heidi Coppola, who's president of REO Clearinghouse. And finally, we're honored to have Yolanda Chavez, who is a deputy assistant secretary for grant programs in the Community Planning and Development Department at HUD. So I'm going to let each of the panelists just briefly give their no more than 5-minute elevator speech about what it is they do and what interventions they have in the market. Then I'm going to let them follow that up by just commenting briefly on what have we missed over the last 2 days, or maybe what has surprised them the most. What did they really learn that they didn't know before they came here? And then I'm going to try and go through what struck me as some of the major themes. And we've really challenged this panel to try and tie everything together and be forward-looking and think about, as Joseph said, what is scalable. I've also asked them to be provocative and maybe disagreeable, or maybe not disagreeable, but at least contentious. So hopefully we'll have a great panel. So let's start off with Mac. I think Mac told me the other day he's provided $75 million in grants in this space. So
not me, but the Ford Foundation.
The Ford Foundation. So why don't you tell us what kind of interventions you've pursued and where you think you've seen the greatest potential success?
Well, thanks, Scott, and thanks, everybody, for having me here. And it's always a great privilege to be here at the Board of Governors and also to eat some of your food, which we've gotten to know quite well over time. I think just before I start, because I'm likely during this panel to say something critical about NSP, I think that it's maybe useful to start by saying that the last day and a half has given me a chance to kind of reflect on the fact that we've actually accomplished a real lot in a very short time. And I think that one of the things that this crisis has led us to do is to kind of accelerate our time. And I think that NSP years are a lot like dog years in that, it takes about, you feel like it's 7 years that you've just lived in the last year. And 18 months out of NSP 1, there's actually been an impressive body of work done. And unfortunately, the problem that we've been trying to address is so huge and unassailable that it's easy to kind of neglect to celebrate what we've been able to do and then to always look at it, how little we've done to put a dent in the problem. I think we have to also remember that we're working with systems that are obsolete and broken, and we've helped to make them much more difficult over the last 20, 30 years to fix. So this is one of the things that we've been actually trying to invest in, which is the right systems that would be useful to fix some of the problems. So I thought what I'd do is just kind of point to what I think are some exemplary things that are likely to give us indications of what's scalable that we've seen around the country. Many of these we've invested in, but not all. The two big ones that we've definitely been major investors in are the National Community Stabilization Trust and their Center for Community Progress. And both of these are actually trying to figure out ways to really build systemic responses to to the broken pieces of the system. In the case of the National Community Stabilization Trust, we're trying to actually fix the brokenness of the mortgage finance system that we went through a gigantic division of labor that made it really impossible for different pieces of that industry to actually talk to each other and to figure out ways to resolve things that kind of that didn't work through their regular conveyor line of mortgage origination and servicing. And one of the things we've seen is that that broken system has been unable to manage millions and millions of properties that have gone into default, and we've got now millions waiting to kind of resolve this foreclosure process and another 2.5-3 million probably in the shadow inventory that Alan and others were talking about earlier. But we've also been investing in local efforts that I think have given us some indication of scalability. You heard on a panel earlier today about the CAPSI effort in New Jersey. They transacted on they did a bulk transaction. They worked through a system that that they used to figure what it would take to actually bring properties through and keep them solvent at the end, right? Which meant that they had to figure out the right acquisition price and they had to know the exit going in so they could actually figure out what they were going to need to do all the way through. And I think that's exemplary because so few of us have actually looked at the entire system from acquisition to exit to figure out what needs to be done. And I think that a lot can be learned there. In Chicago, we've seen the development of a fully articulated business model that that is based on kind of a tool that they've used, a technology tool that's been able to track properties all the way through the process at every moment. And I think it's they made a gigantic investment in it, but it's a fabulous tool. And Mercy Housing, that's been kind of leading that effort in Chicago, was at the helm of that. In Minneapolis, St. Paul, you've heard a lot already about their attempt to transact in bulk and do green rehab as a way to kind of not just get properties re-inhabitable, but actually improve the standard of the properties as a way to actually really turn the tide in those communities. They've also been able to exhibit a huge and effective degree of collaboration internally or across jurisdictions in the Twin Cities. In Boston, you heard from Elise and others about their pre-REO kind of interventions, which are really, really important to know about and to actually think through, because while we talk about neighborhood stabilization and what we're going to do with vacant and abandoned properties, the best way to stabilize a neighborhood is to make sure the properties don't go vacant and abandoned, right? And so we really need to think about, you know, that whole system as well and getting out in front of the problem as opposed to dealing with it when it's really the hardest to deal with. In Denver, we've seen really, really innovative acquisition methods that use regional collaboration and trying to do acquisition with the eye on transit-oriented development, so the properties that get redeveloped are now properties that provide opportunity for the new residents to actually find access to jobs and high-quality properties. And then in New York, we've seen a really innovative program that's tried to marry workforce development. That's a nice try, but I'm going to run through that sign. it's trying to marry workforce development public benefits, where they've actually taken TANF recipients and they've employed them to help stabilize neighborhoods by giving them property management skills, training them in property management skills, and they're going and stabilizing foreclosed properties. They started in one neighborhood in Jamaica, Queens. They've now expanded it to five neighborhoods in the city. And the beauty of this thing is that it's almost all fueled by public money, because the TANF recipients are already getting money to get trained in certain job skills. And in this case, they're just getting trained to do property management stuff. This was the brainchild of Herb Sturz at the Open Society Institute, but it we've invested in it, and now it looks like it's something that can actually go to scale as a way to kind of marry different public programs with a definite public purpose. And then kind of the last topic is back to shared equity, which was really interesting that shared equity, like land banking, was part of the NSP legislation. We've seen now that, and I think, that shared equity is both kind of a response and a prevention strategy, because if you think about shared equity as a mechanism for developing a permanently affordable housing stock, which I think is going to be a component of any sustainable community, then our ability to actually transform properties into some kind of permanent affordability through community land trust, through limited equity co-ops, through other deed-restricted properties is going to keep those properties from entering into the cycle again, because they'll never be part of a speculative frenzy. And we've seen scalable community land trusts and other shared equity models now being developed in places like New Orleans, Denver, Atlanta, the District of Columbia, the Twin Cities, San Francisco and the Bay Area, New Jersey, and Detroit. And we've seen it not only in the residential sector, but we've now been experimenting with shared equity approaches, basically land trust approaches, in the commercial sectors in New Orleans and Detroit. Because very often, if you're trying to redevelop a community, you can't just do it on the residential side, and you can't expect that commercial is ever going to follow. Sometimes you need tandem developments, and as it turns out, in the commercial sector, Land trust arrangements actually work very well for getting community-serving entities there, and people in the commercial space are used to long-term leases as a way of doing business. So I'll be glad to talk more about those. And then I think you'll hear more from Heidi about this. We've really been looking at ways to kind of engage the private sector, particularly the equity funds and others, in finding ways to effectively deal with this low-value property proposition. And I'll leave my remaining time to talk about that later. But that's really some of the out-of-the-box stuff that's just really emerging now.
Great. Thanks so much, Mac. You've really teed up a lot of the themes I wanted to cover this in this hour. So, Frank, as Mac said, you've received funding from both Ford and I know from the C.S. Mott Foundation. I don't know if anyone has mentioned that the center is actually the result of a merger between the National Vacant Properties Campaign and the Genesee Institute, a merger of their staff and their experience. If you could talk about what the center hopes to achieve and what your major interventions are.
Thank you, Scott, and let me add to what so many others have said, my note of appreciation to the Federal Reserve Board and the banks for putting together this conference. I have learned an incredible amount over the last 24 hours, and I mean that really almost literally, because I got up at 3:30 this morning to reread the book, looking for some data points that are missing, and I'll come back to that. But it's a great conference, and I've learned a great deal. The Center for Community Progress, as Scott just indicated, was created in January through a merger functionally of the National Vacant Properties Campaign and the Genesee Institute. This was led by my colleague Dan Kildee, the former treasurer of Genesee County, who created the Genesee County Land Bank. He created the State Fast Track Land Bank Authority in Michigan. He authored, one way or another, the property tax foreclosure reform legislation in Michigan, and then the land bank legislation. What we discovered in our work that had been led by Jen Leonard at the National Vacant Properties Campaign was we couldn't meet the demand from local governments across the country for vacant and abandoned property assistance. So with the support of Ford and Mott, we have gone full-time with a much larger staff doing this nationwide. I think, Scott, I'm going to take these few moments to begin at the end and share with you the things that I'm puzzled about that haven't been said over the past 24 hours or written about in the book you have before you. Dem posts don't meet. I'll try it again. Dem posts don't meet. For those of you who are not from rural Georgia, let me explain this saying. The saying of dem posts don't meet is what you hear at the end of the day when you hired somebody to go put fence posts around your farm to keep the cattle in your pasture. And you thought you knew the boundary lines of that farm, and you carefully calculated the number of posts and the amount of wire you needed. And you sent your employees out there. And for 2 days, they put the posts in the ground and the wire up. And then they came back to you at the end of the day and said, "We're done. Come look at it." And you go out there and you see them posts don't meet. The boundary lines did not close. As a Georgia real estate attorney, what has happened is the legal description did not close. The boundaries were defective. Now, when you don't know the underlying structure of what you've got and the posts don't close, you can do two things. You can go ahead and string wire between the missing 50 feet or 75 feet and try and fill in the gap. Now, that's the way I view the NSP program. I'm a huge proponent of the NSP program because it sure was a heck of a lot better than doing nothing, from my perspective. Not all will agree. And the NSP program, from my perspective, has gotten better almost every month, not just from NSP1 to NSP2, but HUD has constantly heard and made it more functional. But from my perspective, the NSP program is simply stringing the wire across that gap. It is not asking the fundamental questions of why this has occurred. And that's what I have not heard very much of over the last 24 hours. Now, Carolina suggested it yesterday that we might be asking the wrong question or might not be reaching all the right questions. Kai said the same thing. And I think in some ways they were both right. But let me suggest to you the questions that I hope we will ask, if not today, then at least in the weeks and months to come. The first, for me, the simplest question is, what are the products that caused this to happen? Now, most of y'all are too young to remember, but back in the period from 78 to 82, when interest rates were up around 14 to 18% for residential mortgages, the market got creative and came up with something called a graduated payment adjustable rate mortgage with negative amortization, GP ARMs with negative AM. Now, those had a lifespan of only about 3 years before interest rates dropped and the holders of that paper realized it wasn't worth much. But did we prohibit it? No, we didn't. It just took a very short generation, and we came back with the option ARM with negative AM. When will we learn that some products are inherently dangerous, that don't do anyone any good and destroy the community? Isn't it time for us to prohibit, as a matter of state law, if not federal law, some inherently dangerous loan products? The second question that I'm concerned that we're not asking enough is, what are the practices that allow this to occur? I was fascinated by President Rosengren's description of the collateral damage. Yes, this builds on work that Dan Emmergluck did 6-8 years ago. The external costs of foreclosure and abandonment. Or as Alan Malik in another setting said, vacant and abandoned property is not a victimless crime. From my perspective, vacant and abandoned property is the litter of a consumption society. And it has taken us decades to finally deal with litter along the public highways. Perhaps this is time for us to start dealing with the external costs of vacancy and abandonment. If we are going to start forcing, to use the economic language, the internalization of these external costs, we have to know who owns the property. Now, pre-foreclosure, we may have a pretty good sense by doing a title exam of who owns the property. But as the prior panel indicated, as Frank Ford and Judge Bianca indicated, often foreclosure proceedings commence and then we have them not continued to sale. Once foreclosures occur, do we know who owns the property? No one, I suspect, well, let me ask it as a question. Can anyone here tell me how many foreclosure sales actually occurred last month? Last year. Not foreclosure proceedings commenced, because that bears a very weak correlation with foreclosure sales. Can anyone tell me how many sales actually occurred? The answer is no. Now, even if we assumed you did know how many sales occurred, can anyone tell me how much REO is out there today? This entire conference is devoted to REO. But I didn't find a single number in the book that was shared as part of these proceedings that gave me the total REO at any point in time, much less over time. In each article and paper, we're extrapolating, guessing from delinquencies to foreclosures, thinking maybe foreclosures result in sales and maybe sales result in REO. Now, Rob Grossinger this morning told me that in his prior capacity, he knew the REO of his employer at any point in time. But can we aggregate that REO today? And let me suggest to you, perhaps heretically, that I don't think the issue is REO any more than I think the issue is the investor. I think the issue for the community destabilization and the collateral damage is the vacancy and abandonment. Not all REO is vacant and abandoned. But all that is vacant and abandoned, whether it's REO held by the lender or by the purchaser from the lender shortly after foreclosure, all that is vacant and abandoned is harmful. So I think that the question here we need to be asking is why our policies and practices allow this to continue. Now, I do have what I consider to be the 8 critical tools that we need for systemic reform in order to do more than simply bridge the wire across the posts. But I'll wait and share those with you if I have time.
Thanks, Frank. Next we have Heidi of the REO Clearinghouse. For those that don't know, the Clearinghouse is an organization that connects servicers and their REO properties and their pre-foreclosure properties to local governments and nonprofits. Craig mentioned the Clearinghouse yesterday, but maybe you could also elaborate on how the work that the Clearinghouse does complements the work of the trust.
Sure, thank you, and thanks, everybody. I'm very happy to be here today. The Clearinghouse started sometime after the trust did. We were looking at their work and were totally impressed and really awed by the infrastructure that they developed. But my background is I come from Citigroup, and I spent over 20 years there in government relations and community relations and mortgage servicing best practices. And in that capacity at Citi, I was always the proverbial gap filler at the company. I would always look at, you know, everything that they were doing and figuring out exactly what wasn't getting done and trying to figure out how I could fill that gap. So in thinking about what the trust was doing and having some experience with communities on the ground, it occurred to me that there were a lot of things that really couldn't be scalable, which I know goes against the grains of what we're here to talk about right now, but there were a lot of things that really couldn't be scalable because there was no infrastructure, there was no ability to deal with these very difficult situations. So we started the Clearinghouse for the purpose of dealing with aged and distressed low-value assets, which really have to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. So In part, it has to be dealt with on a case-by-case basis because you're really beholden to the resources of a community, to their nonprofit infrastructure, to other resources that exist, as well as to the policies and procedures of the servicers. So we've seen over time with this issue with loss mitigation, loan modifications, for example, there's a very steep learning curve. And we're probably, you know, in that learning curve now with respect to age, distress, low-value assets. So the Clearinghouse was formed really to focus on this particular niche. We do similar things to the trust in that we do have inventory that we can push out, share information related to properties. We also do a lot of reverse inquiries. This is really, on the ground, something that's become extremely necessary and I think very helpful to communities. Organizations go out, they say, listen, we're working through the trust, we've picked up, you know, a handful of properties on these blocks in this neighborhood, but as we're out there looking at 124 Main and 126 Main, we're looking across the street, and we see that there's also a need for 121 and 123. We've gone through title records, we have no idea who owns it, can't figure it out. So this has been a tremendous learning experience for us, as well as the communities, I think, as we try to delve into the ownership of these assets. And I think we're doing a great job with this, but, man, is this labor intensive. So this is one of those situations where, you know, you're just going from one entity and then asking them questions and going back to another entity and really tracing it back. It's gotten us into short sales. It's gotten us into note sales because clearly if this asset that people are asking about was a foreclosed property, was an REO, it would either be on the First Look Program's inventory list, or it would be listed on MLS, right? Somebody would know about it if it were an REO. So what we're finding is that fully 80 to 90% of these assets are pre-foreclosure, which means that if it is one of the servicers that we're all accustomed to dealing with, we can go and flag it and say, listen, when you move this to REO, please keep in mind that this nonprofit organization would like to acquire it. That happens sometimes. Sometimes it's a vacant and abandoned property. Sometimes it's a home that is not being serviced by one of the more well-known servicers. Frequently, there's not a lot of patience in the community to wait around for this to become REO. Sometimes the plan is that it will never become REO. Okay, this is the proverbial charge-off or walk-away. So now we're getting really good at trying to figure out what the strategies are. We've done a little bit of digging into helping communities identify the actual homeowner. So we talked a little bit about this, so that we can facilitate a short sale. So again, while we're all looking for the lessons learned here about, how do we take what we know and make it scalable to help communities, I think so much of what we're doing now is just groundbreaking, right? We're just really trying to figure out how we get to the point where we understand how far we can push the servicers, how much information we can get from them, how far they'll take us down the road of doing a note or a mortgage assignment, how much we can learn about how we avoid charge-offs and walkaways by proposing new alternatives, which we're working on now. And then even with REO, how do we really focus on making decisions about valuation earlier rather than later? Again, because the clearinghouse does focus on age, distress, low-value assets, our inventory generally is 90 days or more on the market. That really puts us at the situation where we've already seen the distress occur on these homes. In many cases, I think it's pretty easy for the servicers to back up their decisioning and really make these decisions about what should be donated or what should be sold at a lower value earlier in the process. And that's what we're trying to push. We're trying to take all this information, upstream the decisioning for the servicer, and then simultaneously prepare the community to accept what they're asking for, which is another issue. We've had situations, again, through the reverse inquiry, where we find an asset that's a pre-foreclosure, and the issue is community wants the asset, but they really want the REO. They don't really want the mortgage or the note. So now we've got to figure out, if we are upstreaming the decisioning, is there capacity to accept what the community is asking for? So these are the issues we're grappling with, and I do think that ultimately we will get to the point where we'll figure out how to make this scalable, but we are still at the point where we are learning about what the issues are and how to solve for making the match between the servicer and the community.
Great. Thanks, Heidi. And finally, Yolanda, you oversee the $7 billion in NSP as well as billions more in other grants. So you might imagine there's been a lot of discussion about NSP over the last 2 days, the good, bad, and the ugly. I wonder if you would share your own perspective about where you see the successes and the challenges to the program.
Sure. Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. I unfortunately was not here yesterday because I was in Detroit. But I know that you've been talking about NSP this last 24 hours, so I don't want to get into the goals. But I do want to focus at least on the achievements on NSP 1. And NSP 1, because NSP 2 is just really starting. And as you know, for NSP 3, we hope to announce the allocations next week. But when we talk about NSP 1, since we're hitting that 18-month obligation deadline, I want to put these achievements in perspective. So when you think of the fact that we allocated $4 billion, almost $4 billion, to 307 grantees, and then those state grantees allocated their funds to a number of local jurisdictions, so we have hundreds more of grantees, along with 307 direct grantees. And we basically ask these grantees, take this money to address your foreclosure problem, to stabilize your neighborhoods, and basically handle a problem that was largely created by the private sector, correct? And I think we should all be clear that prior to NSP, most of these local jurisdictions that had housing finance programs were really providing gap financing, right? They were providing gap financing for multifamily, single family, development, rehab, down payment assistance. They were not out there buying REOs to rehab and resell or to demolish and having to negotiate with a number of servicers to be able to purchase these properties. So that's what we ask these. Without TA, I should say, because NSP1 did not provide money for technical assistance. So our TA actually rolled out in January after we received the NSP2 TA funds. So I think we have to realize that in terms of the... So we asked them to set up a whole new line of business and be able to obligate this money, real projects, real contracts, in 18 months, right? regardless of the fact that it takes a local jurisdiction about 6 months just to set up all their systems and their contracts to actually start the projects. So with that, the other thing that we need to be clear on NSP1 is that it wasn't very targeted, right? I think we all can agree that in order to really stabilize the neighborhood, you have to understand what your market is to be able to target that money, to decide the neighborhood, because you don't have enough money, right, to decide which neighborhoods you should focus on and really target. NSP1 actually provided grantees a lot of flexibility in terms of where they were going to target these funds. So that's the perspective that I'd like you to understand where we are in achievements. So from that perspective, where are we on achievements? So as of today, the obligation rate, the national obligation rate as of today is at 93.4%. 39.4 has been actually expended out of that out of those funds that have been obligated. In terms of vacancy impact, and we have a lot to do in terms of pulling out data and evaluating the program, we do have an evaluation of NSP 1 and 2 starting, but we, with some data that we were actually able to pull out with our partners PDNR and at HUD, what we found is that cities like Reno, Cleveland, Youngstown, Stockton have actually impacted the vacancy rates on the neighborhood level because they've targeted either demolitions, depending on their market, in those neighborhoods, or down payment assistance and rehab if they have a for sale market. And based on what they've done, and these are completed projects, in the various, at the neighborhood census tract level, we have seen a reduction in vacancy rates. Third, that in terms of leveraging, that although our, for the most part, grantees lack the capacity to understand how to leverage their funds, that those with high capacity have actually been able to leverage. And I think one of the biggest achievements is what we've been able to accomplish with technical assistance. Not only the capacity building for the grantees, but also what we've learned about how to do technical assistance and how we've reframed technical assistance to really have it be market-based and provide the assistance to meet the specific needs of each grantee. And how NSP is really going to inform what we're doing, not only with NSP 2 and NSP 3, but also how we're going to provide TA going forward to our grantee population and how we can help them to really look at their resources at a comprehensive level and understand how to integrate and leverage those funds. And I think, as someone mentioned, we learn every day from NSP, and we're working very hard and fast as we learn new lessons to actually implement the lessons to make the program easier and better to implement and hopefully achieve results at the neighborhood level.
Great. Thanks, Yolanda. As I said, before we dig into what I found to be some of the major themes from the past 2 days, we do want to hear from others other than Frank, who used his opening to do this, what you think was missing from the past 2 days, and or what was the biggest surprise to you?
It's not a surprise, but I say one of the things that's really been missing is an actual vision of what a stable neighborhood is. And I think that that's really kind of telling, because we talk a lot about measures that we're going to take to stabilize neighborhoods with some assumption that we know what a stable neighborhood looks like. We heard from President Rosengren earlier today about other indicators of whatever distress in neighborhoods that have that he looked at in the New England area. And I would suggest that the REO is just another indicator of distress. And I would suggest that most of the neighborhoods that we're talking about stabilizing now weren't stable in 2005. They weren't stable in 2000. They're probably not even stable in 1979. And the reason is that these neighborhoods have always been susceptible to negative influences coming from a variety of sectors, one of which is lack of access to credit and capital. And you know, the redlining that happened during the 1960s, that, you know, the response being the CRA, was one of the things that just made it likely that these neighborhoods are always going to be kind of behind the eight ball. And I think that we have to start with the right kind of vision of a stable neighborhood to really think about what it means to stabilize it. And that's why we know going in, even though this is about REO and vacant properties, that stabilizing a neighborhood is not just about dealing with the REO and vacant properties. And I'm not talking about trying to do some high-level comprehensive measures. I'm thinking about what do we need to do, and this is on the prevention side as well as on the proactive side, to think through strategies to make these neighborhoods that have been deeply impacted by the foreclosure crisis and deeply impacted by other crises stable and resilient over the long period. Because just like you know, if you look at Dover, Mass., Dover, Mass. Has some kind of stability and resilience that has brought it through this foreclosure crisis without any major, major damage, right? What makes them stable and resilient? And what makes Lynn less stable and resilient? Or the boomburbs that Carolina Reed was talking about before, those are unstable, and I'd suggest they're always unstable because there's something defective about those communities. They're not close to opportunity. People are going to be having to drive 2.5 hours to go to their jobs from those communities. As soon as jobs disappear, there's no real demand for those homes. So now we have to think about what is the future? What would make those communities stable over a long time? And I might suggest we might try to connect them to the economic mainstream with transportation. But we need to think through the right kind of planning exercises that are going to get us to stability, that are going to go well beyond the systems or just the responses we have in the REO property side. So that's one thing. The second thing is, where is the private sector? Now, we know if we do the math, and someone's already done the math earlier in this conference, that let's say $7 billion in an average cost that we expend on a property is, I don't know, $50,000. We're going to get to 140,000 properties. Well, by the time we're through with this foreclosure crisis, we're thinking about 8 to 10 million foreclosures are going to take place in this country, and we're going to be touching 140,000 properties. We're going to have to be awfully damn strategic to be able to make a big dent in that. But on the other hand, we do know that many of these transactions are going to occur. They're going to occur somewhere along the line, and they're going to occur usually at the behest of private capital. So for better or worse, I've been kind of spending the last 5 years trying to figure out how to align some of the interests of private capital and public purpose. And so I'll just tell you a little bit. We've been working on this most recently with Dana Pancrazzi from the Heron Foundation and also with Harold Simon. The average major transaction that's going to take place in these in this space is going to be a multi-billion dollar transaction in which people are going to buy tens of thousands of notes or properties and then figure out a disposition strategy for them. And I spent a lot of time playing golf and eating steak with some of these guys just to figure out, you know, what were they doing, right? And what they're doing is they're buying at 30 cents, and then they're going to these properties, and they're coming up with kind of wholesale solutions. They triage the whole thing. They find all the occupied properties, and they immediately go to those properties, and they say, well, what if we wrote down your mortgage by 30%? Would you be able to afford that? And they put them into an FHA mortgage, and they exit instantly. And then a few of them, they have to find other kinds of strategies, intermediate strategies for properties that are still desirable. And then there's other flotsam and jetsam that come out of the other end, that's the low-value properties, right? And so we actually convened investors and nonprofits and some philanthropic folks at the Ford Foundation a couple months ago to talk about this. And one of the things that came out of that meeting was, you know what? Those properties that are coming out of that process are the ones that are of the most interest to those of us working at the community level. They're of almost zero value to the investors, and they just, you know, whatever they can get for them, they'll take, but they don't really care. They might sell them on the internet. But what if we found a way to effectively kind of move those properties into more effective public purpose? And the problem is that it's not as simple as it might seem, because you don't want to take a lot of zero value properties and just dump them on, say, a nonprofit, because they don't have the capacity to manage them. They don't have the capacity to incur whatever kind of liability that occurred during the holding period, and they might not be able to actually afford to resolve whatever kinds of legal issues go on around those properties. And so we've recently been talking with Goldman Sachs and others about creating kind of a holding company that would be able to just in the interim period between when the investors are no longer interested in them and then when we are going to find the ultimate solution to them, they'll hold them, resolve whatever kinds of title issues, deed issues that need to be resolved, and then convey them to somebody, presumably like a land bank authority that's being developed in multiple places by the Center for Community Progress. So that's one of the things that I think we need to think about. This is large scale. We've been working with the NCST in this. We're trying to bring CCP into this. But I think that this is where the rubber is going to hit the road in terms of the response on the REO side, because the largest volume of all these solutions is going to be done with private capital, and we have to figure out a way to do it. We have to also be mindful that private capital is in there for profit. They're in there for fast execution, and so we have to figure out a way not to bind them up with our process in the nonprofit space, which incurs brain damage and slowing of everybody else's and frustration, right? And so we need to figure out a way to do that. But this is, I think, the cutting edge of where we're going to get to in the next year or two. And one of the things we really need to figure out is, and there's nobody in the room that represents private equity and the investors that are really buying the large volumes of properties, how we can work together with them to get to a better solution.
Great, thanks. Frank, did you have something else that was missing? You had another point?
let me simply offer the 8 systemic changes that will get us to scale, if that's where you want to go with
sure.
this, Scott. Vacant abandoned properties in neighborhoods are of little interest to anyone except the neighbors and the cities. As Terry described it yesterday, this is the intractable problem of pooling and servicing agreements when there is negative value. Dan Kildee has said that vacant abandoned properties are the problems of vacant abandoned properties are owned by the communities. What we need to do is get the communities now to own the title to the property on these properties, these parcels. And that is what land banks and land banking is about. Going ahead, as Max suggested, and putting it into a public purpose entity, these properties of negative value, pending reuse for a new public purpose. So the first thing is, yes, land banks and land banking. And there's been a growth from roughly 6 land banks a decade ago to somewhere, my guess is, around 250 to 300, depending upon whether you're including land banking as well as land banks. The second systemic change that must occur is property tax foreclosure reform. Those systems were designed in the late 19th century and, for the most part, have not been brought into the 20th, much less the 21st century. And it's time to do that. The third tool in a toolbox that was identified yesterday and described in the materials are vacant property registration statutes. Over 250 local communities have adopted some form of a vacant property registration ordinance, wide varieties among them. The fourth tool, I think, is a ramped-up code enforcement system, which ties into a super priority status of the code enforcement lien and does front-load all of the costs, these external costs, back onto the property owners, including the lenders. The fifth tool that I've begun to think is the simplest one is to start creating a system of foreclosure assessments that each and every foreclosure should carry with it an assessment of $1,000 or maybe $5,000 that is paid directly to the city building and inspection department and perhaps to the police and fire departments to cover the cost of doing the inspection and the vacancy and abandonment. The sixth systemic reform is indeed mortgage foreclosure reform. Sometimes having expedited procedures, sometimes, as referred to earlier, simply notice to the local governments of the commencement of the proceedings. The seventh systemic reform that is necessary is one I've alluded to earlier, which is to totally rethink the structure of pooling and servicing agreements because their incentives are totally misaligned with neighborhood stabilization right now. The eighth and final systemic reform is the fact that we don't have decent data. As I alluded to earlier, we do not know how many foreclosure sales were conducted last month. I have great hopes for the Dodd-Frank provisions that require HUD to begin to accumulate new data. I don't know how you're going to get it, But if we can get better data on what foreclosure proceedings actually result in foreclosure sales and who the purchasers are at those foreclosures, then we'll have a very different approach to what we're doing.
Great. Heidi, Yolanda, was there anything you saw missing?
I was very surprised that there was as much conversation on low-value assets as there was. I don't think we're quite at the point where the, you know, decibel level is deafening, but we're getting there, and I think that's terrific because that's really what we need to solve the issue. We need the conversation. I think that when you look at low-value assets, the one thing that I was touched on at different points but really is not fully evolved yet is this nature of a comprehensive solution. And people on various panels touched on private sector developers coming to the table and actually picking up capacity on the ground. And there's a lot of trepidation about this because the standards of rehab and even execution, you know, what the end game is, what your exit is not always it's not consistent, and it may not be the same as what the nonprofits do. But I do think we've got to come to terms with this, and probably sooner rather than later, because we all see so many of these foreclosed properties now, and we know that the situation isn't. We're expecting many more of these properties to be available by the end of the year, maybe first quarter next year. So we've really got a little window of opportunity here to kind of figure this out and put the right resources in place. So I do think we've got to focus on more on developers, which, again, it was brought up, but, you know, it's almost like, you know, it's just a little too hot to touch right now. We've really got to address this. I think we've also got to address the issue of figuring out what other resources are available on the ground. Evelyn in Boston mentioned that they're using some of the foreclosed properties as supportive housing for formerly homeless individuals. And I think that's amazing because I really think that there are resources and maybe other funding streams, and that's what I'm referring to, in local government that we really could apply to foreclosed properties. I come from the servicer world, and we all thought about services as being very siloed. So the pre-foreclosure department or loss mitigation didn't talk to the foreclosure department. The foreclosure department didn't talk to the REO department. You know, and we see that now, right, because we go back and we say, gee, we've got a foreclosed property. We go to our REO contact. They say, that's great, but it's not an REO, so you need to talk to somebody else. We can't give you their name. You know, you're on your own. So we see this, right? And I know, you know, because I come from that world. So we figure it out. But I think the same thing is existing in the cities. So I think that maybe it's time to take social services and the housing department that focuses on homelessness and, in addition to other areas that have the funding streams, put them in a room with the foreclosed property, the people who have access to the foreclosed properties, and kind of say, all right, how are we going to use these properties in a different way? Because all the things that we're talking about in terms of creating these holding tanks and these land banks, it's all great. Because it helps us understand where the concentrations of properties are. But at the end of the day, it all comes down to what you're going to do with that property, right? Because otherwise, anybody who's taken that property is just stepping in the shoes of the servicer who's getting their hand slapped every single day. So the question is, how do you really use this, and where can you get creative about finding these resources?
Great, thanks. I think we'll go ahead and jump into the themes.
A couple of members of the NSP team were here yesterday, and so I'm teeing a little bit about one of the things that was mentioned about what HUD should have done initially with NSP, and what that brought, or the thought that I had when they gave me kind of their comments on what they heard, was that it's interesting that we all assume that with NSP that suddenly local jurisdictions would know how to address their housing market. I think you're all making the assumption that HUD also has been focused on market-based programs. And the reality is that formula programs, as you all know, don't allow you to do that, right? With NSP, and from what we've learned with NSP, so we've learned, one, that our grantees, part of their issue, part of local jurisdictions, they do not understand how to assess their housing market for the most part. And we're hoping that NSP1 with the TA has helped them do that. With HUD, being place-based really means in order to be place-based, we have to become market-based. And with NSP, we're doing that and learning to do that. And so the last three things I would end with, which I'm sure that you've covered, is that what HUD can do in helping jurisdictions do this is that how do they take any of their planning to scale is they have to really understand how they can use all of their funding resources, not just NSP. NSP is not the only thing they could be looking at to stabilize their neighborhood, but how they use home, CDBG, any other private resources they have to be able to do that. And we think that we could help with that role. That is our role, to help our grantees get to that level. And then, of course, the challenge to all of you is how do we ensure that in still strong real estate markets, how we provide credit for first lien, so it should not be just FHA. Two, as Mac mentioned, how do you invest with NSP grantees to develop loan revolving pools that they could use for single family or multifamily? And that's really going to be the focus, because in a lot of these markets, maybe it's just a rental market. So how do you help them do that and invest? And three, these low-value REOs, there's not enough NSP money. So how do you transfer these titles to grantees in low-value markets and give them the money for the demo so that you do your part in helping them stabilize those neighborhoods?
Great, thanks. I should also say we've been told we can go a little longer since we got a late start with this panel. So we will do a hard stop at 1:45. But so you basically have all raised what I saw as the major themes from the conference that I want to elaborate on. So I thought maybe we'd go through them one by one, let you guys comment a little bit more, and then open each one up to the audience for questions or ideas. The themes that I saw were the need for leverage, the need to think more comprehensively about neighborhoods, how to deal with community capacity, particularly in areas that just don't have it, how to deal with the low-value properties. So maybe one by one. So, Mac, you already went into some detail about leverage, both in the CDFI space, talking about CAPC and Elise's program in Boston, but also about going to the private market. I don't know if you want to elaborate any more about that. And, I mean, how would we, in particular on the CDFI side, bring that to greater scale across the country?
Well, one of the things that we were surprised to see, I mean, we helped to invest in the capital corporation of the National Community Stabilization Trust because we hoped to allow people to leverage their NSP money with that capital. And we were actually really, really surprised, and maybe it was just too early at the, you know, out of the gate, that there was very little demand. And one of the reasons, I think, for that was that it's actually very risky for a developer of properties to incur debt to then take on properties you're going to redevelop with no known exit. And so the issue there is that unless we've actually solved the permanent financing problem, and I don't care if you're going to rent these things long-term, lease to own, or if you're just going to sell them to new buyers, we haven't secured a long-term capital source that's reliable that gives anybody an exit. And so it's no mystery to me why we've seen so little demand for the capital pool that's already available for people to leverage their NSP money. And so I think one of the things, and this has already been talked about at this conference, is that we need to find a way to share the risk with whomever is going to provide the takeout financing to deal with these properties long term, whether it be mortgages or whether it be someone who's going to carry the leases. We just need that capital source, and it's not there yet.
You're right. I think Amanda from Enterprise raised the issue yesterday afternoon, the possibility of a new mortgage program, either on the federal or state level. I mean, is that really something we should advocate going forward out of here?
All right. It's either a mortgage program on the federal or state level. I mean, we have, you know, home loan banks. We have state housing finance agencies that can step into the breach. We've also got CRA, and we've got duty to serve. I mean, we have many tools that we can use to cajole or coerce lenders to actually get into the space, and we could think about risk-sharing mechanisms that would make it possible. But it's not that far out of the box to think about a dedicated, publicly supported finance product that would be used to be takeout financing for any property that's acquired using NSP money. It's as simple as that. And we're going to just share the risk down the line, just in the same way that TARP shared the risk for investors when they took on Tarnier's assets, right? We did it before. We've done it in many other ways. But I think it's just not that far out of the box.
Yeah. So, Yolanda, this was a common theme here, the lack of mortgages, in particular for LMI households, in many cases were the ones displaced from the foreclosed homes. Is this something HUD is thinking about, trying to boost the possibility of mortgages for this area?
Well, I think I guess that's the challenge that I make here to the lenders present, because FHA, I think, is doing their part. I think that you could definitely help us in terms of a capital source. That's also something else that private lenders should be playing a role in. You can't, I mean, government is, you know, $7 billion is a lot of money. I think you all know what the environment is on the Hill in terms of putting more money into some of these programs. So where does the private sector come in a private sector created problem? So I think we're working as hard, as fast as we can at HUD, and so I challenge the lenders here present.
Why don't we open this one topic up to the audience? Anyone want to comment on successful efforts to leverage the NSP and other funds in this area?
One of the things that Mac said that I'm curious about is how
are you anyway?
Yeah, right. Dan Kildee, Frank Alexander's luggage handler. He carries a lot of baggage. Well, Mac said something that I actually think of as being pretty provocative, and it's this sort of land trust shared equity model in weak markets. And, you know, a lot of the conversation about where do we go with these properties at the back end, how do we finance the redevelopment or the ownership aspect of this. And I'm wondering how you see that playing out and coming to scale. Is it a sort of a new ownership paradigm that you're promoting, or is it intended to retain the subsidy in the property long term or create some sort of stability to that property in case there are problems that occur downstream? I'm really kind of curious to see how, first of all, why, and then how this model would work in these weak markets, and because it is a bit of a new concept for me to grasp, using a shared equity or land trust model in something other than a very high land cost environment.
So, well, you know, as Elise said earlier, this isn't necessarily, especially in low cost markets, a profit center, right? And it might not even pay for itself in the long run. But the idea, the first principle is responsible use of public subsidy. So if you're going to be providing gigantic amounts of gap filler subsidy because you can't get the appraisals you need to cover the acquisition and the rehab costs of homes that you put in through NSP, then you just get a recapture mechanism put in so that at least long term those properties are maintained as affordable, or you recapture the subsidy to put someplace else. I think the innovative thing that we're seeing in some of the in the distressed markets, and there's only two that we're really working in, New Orleans and Detroit, is that being able to marry a commercial development strategy with a residential development strategy, and using the land trust model in the commercial side to make sure that you get beneficial commercial service to places that don't have residences. Because you know that nobody's going to do commercial development in a place that doesn't have rooftops. And then who's going to live in a place that doesn't have any commercial services? And this is really true in both of those places. So the idea would be to do tandem shared equity kinds of arrangements on the commercial and on the – so it's like it's a different kind of mixed-use model, basically. But the idea is that the land is held in trust so that you can actually have community control over those assets for the long haul. And so so you're right. I mean, there's no gigantic upside that you see, at least in the short to medium term, in the residential markets, in these low-cost markets. But on the other hand, you want to be able to defend the use of public subsidy that's going to be gap filler, and you want to be able to figure out tandem strategies that will likely lead in the long run to appreciation in those markets, but you're going to have to figure out how to do it. And right now we're struggling with the financial model, which seems to be subsidy-driven, at least in this point. So it's not going to be kind of scalable and self-financing, at least right off the start. I don't know if that answered your question, but it's a tough haul, because on the residential side, I mean, basically if no one's looking at price appreciation, who wants to buy anyway? And if you're going to claim some of it down the line, why is anybody going to do it? But what we found is that even in markets like New Orleans and possibly Detroit, we haven't seen this yet, there are people who would like to buy homes who wouldn't otherwise be able to buy homes. But if you can bring the price point down by this mixing of public subsidy and the sharing of equity, you can get a lot of people in who wouldn't otherwise be in. And so that's kind of a different benefit you can bring.
Great. Any other comments or questions on this whole issue of leverage? Mary, sure.
Yes. First of all, I want to say, Mary Tingerthal from the Housing Partnership Network, I do want to say I really agree with Mac on the The need to address the question of permanent financing, takeout financing for the borrowers. It is an emerging issue and one that is stalling pipelines. But a question that came up yesterday, and Yolanda, since we have you here today, I'm just wondering if you'd be willing to comment. As we know, there's some technical issues with being able to utilize NSP dollars for things like guarantees for loan funds and such, because there's questions about if those don't get utilized, which you hope they don't, then they cause problems with obligation or expenditure of funds. And I just wondered, do you see any possibility that there might be some relief in that respect, either in NSP 2 or NSP 3, so that we can begin to look at more leveraging strategies with those two pots of money?
The answer is yes. And we're hoping to issue guidance, hopefully, by next week on that issue.
Great. I think we'll move to another issue. And this came up several times already this morning from President Rosengren, you know, talking about a real focus on communities, to Alan talking about trying to rebuild confidence in neighborhoods. And maybe we'll start with Yolanda talking about this. How do we take a more comprehensive approach in these distressed neighborhoods? We actually heard yesterday that the NSP process has resulted in a number of localities learning to better target even their CDBG. But are you guys sort of working on this issue, and does it tie in with some pilots you're doing, like Choice Neighborhoods and other ways to tie mm-hmm. programs together?
We are. Part of what NSP has informed is the way we're going to be doing TA at CPD overall for all of our grantees, our over 7,000 grantees, including our continuum of care grantees. And the way we're going to do it is, in fact, our TA NOFA that will be out fairly soon is actually titled One CPD. And what we're going to be asking the TA providers to do going forward is to really look at the grantees in a comprehensive way and to look at their funding resources so that they're able to really understand how to leverage, how to plan, how to target better. And to also be able to give them the data that they need to do that. Part of the challenge is that for local grantees, for local governments and housing managers and administrators who are running these programs, we need, and I'm going to be really blunt, we need to give them some political cover, right? Decisions at the local level are political decisions. You have professional managers, but you also have council members and mayors. And so what are the tools that we could give them so they're making the right decisions on where they're targeting and how they're leveraging their funds? And the only way to do that is to give them the data that they need so that their elected officials understand where the needs are, so that the data is public, so that when they have the public discussion on how they're targeting the money, people understand, what they're making decisions on. And to build the capacity at that level. I mean, one of the biggest surprises to me coming to HUD and working with our grantees is the lack of capacity and the challenge. In an environment where they're having additional challenges because of a budget constraint, right? And so if we can help them, instead of looking at their money as NSP and CDBG and home and then everything else, and understand how all of these funds can be used for a foreclosed property or, multifamily for economic development, how you use these funds across the board in a comprehensive manner, that is our goal. And if we can get to that point, it's going to be an incredible accomplishment, because at this point, they're very, except for the large high-capacity grantees, which you all know, New York, Chicago, Boston, L.A., Seattle, those are the outliers. The majority of the grantees, I was in Detroit yesterday, and part of the reason I was there because we're starting a pilot with them to help them develop a comprehensive housing and community development plan with their formula funding and everything else they have available for the next 5 years.
Great. Any of the other panels want to weigh in on how to enhance our focus on neighborhoods?
Well, just want to say one thing. We're focusing on this comprehensive strategy, but we haven't really heard too much about the rental component here. And I think it's very important to focus on this, because a lot of these very distressed markets really were created for a lot more residents than they have today. And a lot of people in these markets, of course, have been foreclosed on, and they're not going to be owning a home in the next year or two. And so I do think that we've got to focus on this. I've also seen some interesting models in terms of profit sharing or revenue sharing going forward in this space with joint ventures with servicers and with others focused on the rental piece of this. And I think that's kind of interesting because there's capacity for single-family scattered site development in this area among the for-profit developers. And I think that there's some cash flow. So it's not all about the appreciation on the property at the end of 5 years.
Great.
What I'd stress there, Scott, is that the decisions have to be so contextual. The concept of leverage that Mac is advocating, private capital leverage, makes very little sense if we're not dealing with a housing situation. I mean, if we're dealing with a loss of 30% of your population, we don't need more affordable housing. We need to take down the housing stock that's there. So I think that the one of the most important things is, as we look at community stabilization, is we be very realistic about the forecast for that community in terms of population growth over the next generation.
You know, it's interesting to think through what that means, because I think one of the things that we need to be mindful of is that, let's say in the case of Detroit or Youngstown, right, these are places that have probably lost 60% of their population now, but where are they going to end up, right? And so the kinds of strategies you have to engage in now, these are land use strategies and planning strategies that are going to benefit some targeted neighborhoods if they remain, but they're going to have substantially different land use patterns for the other property, right? Mm-hmm. And so we're going to see some really interesting things coming out of this planning process in Detroit. They've really already begun this process in Youngstown, where they're really thinking through strategies that don't take that fantasy path of saying, all right, we want to get back to the golden age when Detroit had 2 million people. But we want to think about, well, Detroit has 800,000 people now. How do we keep it at 800,000 people or maybe at 1 million people and not let it kind of decay to the point where it's 500,000, right? And part of that is actually making the tough choices about where you place your investment and then how you turn the rest of the properties into amenities, right? And that's greening, that's other mechanisms that actually make the place more desirable to live in. And this is really, really creative work, and it's really tough work, and it's politically sensitive as well. So it's at a very different stage. It's not about how you use your NSP money, but it's how you actually marshal your local forces to really think through that kind of strategy and get people to kind of bite the bullet and understand that they're now at a crossroads, not about getting back to the golden past, but about what their future really is and which future they're going to actually choose.
Great. Any questions or comments from the audience on the whole neighborhood issue?
I think Catherine wanted to get on the leverage thing a minute ago.
Oh. Go ahead.
Sorry to take us back. That's Catherine right. Gottschalk with Self Help. So we are, and we have been trying to play in this sort of permanent financing, leveraging NSP, providing the sort of end loan takeout for a number of years now. And Mac, I think your point about maybe it was just too early is, I think, a valid one. I also think, Yolanda, that there's some inherent challenges in using NSP 1 or 2, and I'm assuming 3, to provide permanent financing, just because of when you're trying to sort of do it at a level that's not very geographically targeted, but rather sort of leveraging nationally because of the lack of geographic flexibility, and also the whole issue of providing pool guarantee as opposed to specific loan level loss guarantee loss reserves. So I basically just wanted to make that point that there's I think that this is fundamental, even where we have really tried very hard to provide. To provide the permanent financing, the takeout, there's the issue of if the alternative is just free NSP money at 100% financing of that property, from the developer perspective, there's really no incentive for them to take on debt that just increases their risk there. And that's one of the fundamental challenges that I think will, the point of only really reaching 140,000 properties on a problem that's scaled of 8 to 10 million foreclosures, I think the incentive will increase to revolve the dollars and generate more program income, but it's just not, we're not quite there yet.
Great, thanks. Now, I want to be mindful of the fact I promised everyone we could leave at quarter till. I'd like to give each panelist just 1 minute to close and maybe frame it in terms of someone yesterday said, oh, gee, I wish we'd have known 2 years ago that we needed to focus more on TA for NSP grantees or, you know, something of that effect. So why don't we think of it in reverse? 2 years from now, looking back to today, think, you know, what am I glad that we really focused on and really put effort into to really bring these programs at stabilization to scale?
All right, I'll jump in. So I think that I'm going to be very happy that we invested in the Center for Community. and the reason I think so is that I think that, and Frank and I have talked about this for long periods of time, that if we come out of this crisis with kind of a new set of mechanisms to actually manage property locally, we move from the 19th century kinds of property management tools that we have to 21st century tools, then we'll have come a real long way. And I think that there's promise there. And as Frank says, if we move from being first responders to epidemiologists, I think that what we're going to find is that one of the things that makes communities resilient are the tools available to be responsive when something goes wrong. And right now, those tools in the property management, the tax foreclosure, the code enforcement, all those tools are not really effective, but they can be. So.
Great, Frank.
I think 2 years from now, what I'll be rejoicing in is what we've learned as a result of Dodd-Frank for this field, for the data, perhaps for the Bureau, but certainly for the data, and how that has allowed us to really move forward with the systemic changes so that we're not simply stringing the wire between the posts that don't meet, but we're actually figuring out where the boundary lines are.
Interesting. Okay. Heidi?
I think I'd look back and be glad for the level of collaboration between the public and the private sector, particularly on a community level. I think a lot of the servicers are coming to the table around particular challenges in particular communities, and I think that that's really unprecedented to see the coordination the way we have it today on a local level.
Great. The final word, Yolanda.
So I'm going to be very happy about the fact that we spent the time and the resources on building capacity at the local level, because whether it's foreclosures or any other thing that comes to these cities, if we can increase their capacity to assess their situation and better target their resources, I will be very happy about that.
Great. Well, thanks to the audience for letting us go the extra 15 minutes, but join me in thanking